Well, first of all, thank you for being here. I was looking at the schedule and I'm like, man, there are too many good classes. The fact that you're here, I do appreciate it. At least there's a couple people to talk to. My name is Nephi Zufelt, and I should probably mention this is about creation and consumption, so if you're in the wrong place, I won't be offended if you have to slip out. But today I want to talk about, we're going to start with consumption, okay? We're going to talk about kind of what's happening in the world around consumption and how it's, we all recognize that we live in a world that is very much designed to consume our time, to consume our resources. And it's always been that way, right? Part of what we do is we consume resources to do certain things, but the world has really become a consumptive world. And then we're going to shift gears. So that's going to be a little bit, I'll be honest, it's going to be a little bit dark at first because it is a little bit overwhelming. But then we're going to shift gears and we'll move into maybe some happier things as we talk about how do we fight back against this consumerism and talk about production. So this particular talk, you guys, about five years ago now, this idea came to me, and so I talk about these four horsemen. I've given this talk several times since then. But the idea came to me as it actually happened right here, not in this building, but here on this campus. A few years ago, I was talking to a group of about 100 young people between the ages of 14 and 18. And I was talking about just kind of the challenges that they're facing that are unique to this generation. And as we were going through that, I started to talk about these four horsemen, not the literal four horsemen of the apocalypse, but the four horsemen of their time, which are anxiety, depression, addiction, and suicide. And so I was talking about those four things that they're dealing with at really a higher rate than we've ever seen in the history of the world. And I just, on a whim, I decided I just wanted to ask them questions about that. So what I did was I said, okay, let's start with anxiety. And I asked everybody in the room, anyone in the room who's ever struggled with anxiety personally or has a close family friend that struggles with anxiety, please stand up. Right? And so in that group of about 100 youth, every single one of them stood up. That's not a surprise, right? Like, we know that that's a struggle that many of us have. And so then I said, let's go to the next level. So anybody in this room who's struggled with depression or has a close family member that struggled with depression, please stand up. And all of them stood up. I said, okay, anybody who's personally struggled with addiction or has a family member that struggles with addiction, you know, stay standing, and everyone else that doesn't can sit down. And nobody sat down. And so then we went to the last one. Anyone who has ever considered or attempted suicide or has a family member that's committed suicide or attempted suicide, please stay standing, and everyone else sit down. And nobody sat down. In 100 youth between the ages of 14 and 18, every single one of them had experience with those four really, really challenging things. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I'm pretty sure that if I had asked my peers 30 or 20 years ago, when I was that age, that same question, that would not have been the result, right? Like, we obviously had some of those struggles, but not at the same level. And so, in a very real way, our youth are dealing with something really, really tough. This is some data on self-harm and suicide. So the red line is suicide, the blue line is self-harm, 2001 through 2020. And this is incidents per 100,000 people. And so you can see, and this is, you know, 2020 captures a little bit of the COVID data, but after that it continued to go up during COVID. Luckily, after COVID we've had a slight decrease, but it hasn't gone back down to where it was before. And I just want you to notice kind of that of the inflection point. Right around 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010 seems to be an inflection point. Does anybody know what happened in 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010 that could have caused this type of thing to increase?
The market crash.
Okay, there was the market crash. That could definitely contribute to some of this. Let me show you guys another graph.
But is this graph just for youth or is it for all?
This is just for young people. That's
but
right.
I feel like the market crash would have quite an effect on young people.
Yeah.
Adults.
That's when Apple released its first smartphone.
2007 iPhone, right? 2010 iPad. So we had smartphones and things like that start. Let's look at a couple of others. This is young people. So this is 12th graders, 10th graders, and 8th graders, and their interest in dating. Again, this is about 2007. This is our youth and how eight. Now, for you guys, I don't know about you guys, I could not wait to start driving when I was 16. Like, I was so freaking excited. But this is the number of people who are interested in driving. So this is people who have driven in the last year and people who have licenses. And those numbers, this is 2015, the numbers continue to go down. And so something has fundamentally changed for these youth. On the left is likely to get enough sleep. So percentage of 8th, 10th, 12th graders who get less than 7 hours of sleep at night. So you can see they're not sleeping. Why are they not sleeping? Because they have their devices. More likely to feel alone. So our loneliness, you guys, this is something that I'm very concerned about, in fact. We are a lonely generation. And it's a lot of that, I believe, is being driven by these devices and what's happening in there, the way that we are consuming the world, the way that we're engaging with the world. So in a very real sense, our youth were struggling with some of these things in a way that we just don't really understand. And, well, let me take that phrase back. We are struggling with this in a way that we really haven't had to in past generations. Because I don't know about you guys, I don't have it figured out either, right? Like, I don't have devices figured out. Maybe you guys have the secret sauce, but I struggle. I struggle with device uses. I struggle with consumption. It's something that I think we're all trying to figure out. So how do we, well, actually, I'm going to skip that part just for a second. So I'll come back to this. I want to go to this here. Some of you guys may have seen this before. So what this is for our 18-year-olds, anybody have 18-year-olds? My daughter's 17, turning 18. So for an 18-year-old that lives to the age of 90, that's 72 years, each of these bubbles represent 1 month of their life. So this is the total amount of time that they have left in their lives. Each row is worth 3 years or 36 months. Now, I showed this to the teenagers yesterday, and I said, does that seem like more or less? Like, that doesn't seem like very much. Is that real? Like, yeah, this is the math, right? Like, this is what you have. And so I went through this with them, and I wanted to go through it with you guys today. So let's imagine you spend 8 hours a day sleeping. That represents about 24 years of your life, 288 months, automatically go towards sleep. Now, I know some of us sleep more or less than this, but that's kind of the average. Work and school will consume about 126 months. Of their life. And at this point, the teenagers are like, oh, that's a lot of time. And some of them are like, I don't think I'm going to sleep as much anymore. and that wasn't the intent. So driving, if you drive 30 minutes a day, that's about 18 months of your life that goes towards driving. Cooking and eating, if you spend an hour a day cooking and eating, that's about 3 years or 36 months of your life. Only an hour? Yeah, that's true.
6 hours.
That's true. If it's more, if we moved to Europe, we could spend like all day eating, right? You just kind of sit around. It's wonderful. Housework and errands, again, that represents about an hour. The dads are like, that seems like a lot. And the moms are like, whoa, that's not very much. Bathroom and hygiene. You're going to spend 27 months, almost a little over 2 years of your life in the bathroom, getting ready and using the commode. So what that means is, for these young people, that represents they have about 334 months of additional free time to do the things that they want to do, to spend their life the way that they want to spend it. Now, again, the youth yesterday were like, that doesn't seem like that much. And I said, no, it really doesn't, right? Like, it really does go fast. But here was the point of the graph. On average, our 16 to 18-year-olds right now in their lives are spending 8 hours and 40 minutes a day on screens. That screen time outside of just the time at school and work. And so what that means is they're going to spend 312 of those additional months sitting in front of screens if they represent that average. That is 93% of their remaining life is going to be spent in front of a screen. And it gives them about 22 months, a little bit less than 2 years, to do all the other stuff. Now, my my daughter and her friends this morning, they came up to me and they said, one of her friends, one of my younger daughter's friends said, "I really don't like you this morning." And I said, "Why don't you like me this morning?" And she said, "I cannot unsee that graph, and I wish you had never shown me that graph." And they started making all these excuses of, you know, I need my screen and this kind of stuff. But this is the reality that faces us. And it's not getting any better, right? So back in 2015, our teens were only spending about 6 hours and 40 minutes on their screens. It's gone up 2 hours in those 6 years between 2015 and 2021. I don't have data actually on 2023, 2024. But it's a trend that's not going in the right direction. So what I did with them, and I'm going to do with you guys, pull out your phones. Let's see how we're doing. So on your phones, if you have an Android, you're going to go to settings. Everybody actually go to settings, whether you're on an Android or an iPhone. For Android users, if you're going to go down to your digital well-being and parental controls. For iPhone users, you're going to go to, I think it's called screen time. There's actually a screen time in there. Click on it. And so I don't want to know for today because we're just starting. Mine says 20 minutes. I'm like, yeah, I'm doing great today. But if I go back, If I go back throughout the rest of this week, so my highest day is actually Tuesday this week. Looks like I watched a movie when I worked out and some other things. And so I had 5 hours and 9 minutes on my screen as the highest this week. To give us some of your times, I asked the youth to do this.
I'm still trying to figure out how to find it, so I'll tell you when.
Okay. Yes.
My daily average is 5 hours and 34 minutes.
Okay, 5 hours and 30. You're about with me.
So daily average over the last week was three and a half hours, but on last Wednesday it was almost 7 hours.
7 hours. And remember, for me, and I'm glad for you guys, this is just one of my screens, right? Like I spend a lot of time in front of computers and other things as well. This is just one of my screens. So I'm not doing great. Anybody else brave enough? So I was actually impressed yesterday. Your kids are doing pretty well. Some of them were like at an hour, a couple hours. The average that I took out of that group was about 3 hours. Anyone else brave enough, though? Do we have any?
4 hours?
2.5 hours?
6 hours.
6 hours.
Like, that's my highest.
My highest is six. Okay, any other highs, Laura?
So I'm about 7 hours on average, but I found a book. So this week I'm at two.
I love the justification.
Because it's like I found something else to replace it.
I do have a question. Does it count like audiobooks and like when you're listening to stuff on
it does actually count that. So that would, if it's running in the background and it's actually actively doing something, I think it does count that time. Yep. Okay. So you guys, this is obviously something we're struggling with, right? Like, it's not something that's just for our youth. Here's what I told them, and I'll tell you, is the math is actually pretty straightforward.
4 hours now?
So, we got something embarrassing somebody back here. What have you been doing? So, you guys, the math is actually pretty straightforward. For every hour that you spend in front of your screen, that equates out to 36 months or 3 years of your life over that 72 years. So it goes both directions, right? So if you add an hour, you consume another 3 years of your life. If you decrease an hour, you get back another 36 months of your life. And again, my daughter was like, yeah, but I don't do that every day, and et cetera, and there's a lot of justifications. It's just simple math. Like, it's not your life. It's not your reality. It's just a representation of what these screens are doing and what they're taking away from us. Your kids, and I'm guessing you, when you get to be 90 and you look back, you're not going to be like, man, I'm so glad that I spent 93% of my extra time on a screen. That was a life well lived, right? I think all of us have other things that we want to do, other things that we want to accomplish, and the screens are a challenge for us. They're something that we're all having to deal with, and we're all struggling with, to be really honest. Any thoughts or comments or questions about this? Go ahead.
I have lived my life very different from other people because of my mental issues. I had to get rid of Facebook years and years ago. So it's been a simple life, but very fulfilling. And the depression's gone. A lot of the anguish is gone now because I don't use it that way. Like other, I woke up. And now it feels like everyone else is asleep, and that's quite difficult, especially if you have a spouse that's still kind of not there yet.
It can be a struggle, right? It can be a struggle when we make some of those changes and others aren't. I saw another hand back here. Yeah.
I'm surprised, like, I've already been on it 1 hour and 8 minutes this morning, and all of it is communication with stuff going on with projects at home and here or there. So I'm thinking, wow, I've spent 1 hour while I've been here, and I'm thinking, oh, my woman brain is totally, what is it called when you can multitask?
Multitasking,
you know?
Yeah.
Because I can tell you what the last class was about. But still, it's a little haunting. But on the other hand, the reality is we've got ourselves in so many pots and pies that it is consuming. You have to communicate here and communicate there and communicate.
Yeah. There's other data in there to look at sometimes. Sometimes I'll look in and see how many times I pick up my phone and turn it on. It'll actually tell me how many times I do that in a day. And it's like, really? Or how many messages or notifications I get in a day. And it's in the hundreds. I'm like, holy crap. Like it. And I like what you just said, because the usage of the phone, while complex and somewhat troubling, is really a symptom of other things sometimes. It's a symptom of the fact that we're oftentimes overprogrammed, overworked, we're splitting ourselves amongst too many things, and it shows up, interestingly enough, in some of the way that we use our devices. Yeah, so that's really good. Thank you.
And I think this data and our own data is a good indication and a good, I guess, wake-up call. Since this is such a part of our lives now, what are we using it for?
Yeah.
What's its purpose? What's its use? And is it worth the time that we're on it? Because it's so integrated into so many pieces and parts of our lives. It's a good time to evaluate each piece. And it's like, okay, do we want that part? And do we want that much time on that part in our lives? Because, I don't know, it's a handheld computer. It has more technology than they used to go to the moon in 1969.
Yeah. Let's talk about that a little bit more. I love that concept. Let's talk about it just a little bit more. And I'm getting a little out of order, Mike. So if my presentation doesn't make any sense, it's your fault, okay? No, I'm just kidding. No. Let's talk about devices in general and just this idea. So I think we can all agree that consumption is not the desirable state that we want to be in. Some consumption is wonderful and great, and we need some of that for just, you know, to relax and sit down and take a breather. But in general, production is this desired state. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a second. But it's just concerned. I'm not even that concerned. If one of my kids comes to me and says, I have spent 8 hours on a device today. Like, part of my brain says, oh my gosh, 8 hours, that's crazy. Like, that graph, and you just gave up, whatever. Like, that's 3,333 months over 7 years. And I want to say all of those things. But what's more important is actually this graph. So, on average, the way that our teenagers are using it is 196 minutes of that time, a little over 3 hours, is spent on TV and videos. Now, we all know what that means in modern times. It means that they're doing short-form video content, right? They're scrolling through TikTok, they're scrolling through Reels or YouTube Shorts, because that is the addictive kind of in-vogue thing right now. And so 3 hours of that is just spent looking at these videos. We have gaming and social media and browsing websites. And way, 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 way down on the bottom, e-reading is about 15 minutes, and content creation is 14 minutes. So let's go back to that, my child who spent 8 hours on the phone. If they say to me, I spent, 6 hours watching movies all day and playing video games, and then 1 hour reading, that's a problem. I'm going to have a talk with that child. But on the flip side of that, if my child says, Dad, we spent all afternoon, in fact, this happened 2 weeks ago, a couple of our kids, they couldn't go to something that they wanted to go to, and so they and their friends came to our house, and they're just hanging out, and they wanted to be productive. And so they spent like 6 or 7 hours making a movie. And so they dressed up, they ran around the house, they recorded it all, they put it all together, and at the end of the day, they were super, super proud about this incredibly goofy, ridiculous, funny movie that they had made about King Henry and his many, many wives. And that's what, so that 8 hours is not the same as this, right? That's the type of thing. If my kids are like, Dad, I've been working on creating my software program, or I'm working on creating music, or I'm working on this. Device usage is actually pretty incredible. And this is backed up by evidence. Back in 2019, there were some studies that were done. The name of the lady was Burnell. Caitlin Burnell was one of the first ones to do this. What she looked at, all of the studies that have ever been done comparing device usage and non-device usage have always had that question of, is it worse on people to use devices in social media or to not use devices in social media? And so there's been tons and tons of studies, and every single one of them say device usage is way worse on our mental health, on our emotional health, on everything else, our physical health. Device usage is negative for us on whole compared to not using device. Well, Dr. Burnell came along and said, well, that's just not realistic. Everyone is going to use devices in our life. In fact, if I ask your kids, I did this a few years ago with a group of homeschoolers. I said, how many of you guys have devices right now? Again, that same demographic of these teenagers. And about, I think it was about 40% of them raised their hands. That number's come up slightly in the last few years, but that about 40, 50% of homeschoolers have a device already. But then the question was, when you turn 18, are you going to have a device? Guess how many hands went in the air? Every single one of them, and they all plan on having a device. There's no question. And so Dr. Burnell said, we are going to have devices. We're going to be on social media. We absolutely have to. So what she wanted to know is not our devices, is device usage worse than non-device usage? She wanted to know, is the way we use devices different? And so she ran studies, and this has been repeated and done by other individuals, where they take what they call active device usage versus passive device usage. Passive device usage means I get on there, I watch TV, I play video games, I get on social media, and when I'm on social media, I just scroll through the feed and I look at everybody else's lives and envy what's happening in their lives. And like, it's this very passive, consumptive usage of devices. Active usage means I got on my device, I was on social media, I posted a few things to update my friends, I utilized it to read a book, that maybe falls into consumptive, but I made a movie, I played some music, like it's a very active, I'm doing something, I'm producing something, I'm putting something out into the world activity. She compared those two different things. And interestingly enough, active usage of devices is almost as good on our mental health, our emotional health, our physical health, as not using devices at all. It's not the same. There is still a detrimental effect. It's not as good as not using devices at all. But it's almost as good as not using devices at all. And so the way that we use these devices, the way that our kids are engaging with it, the way that we're engaging with it, makes a very, very large difference on how it's affecting us in every aspect of our lives. So what I say about devices, you guys, when it comes to this idea of production and just devices in general, I view it kind of as, it's parallel to me with driving a car. Using a device is an incredibly dangerous thing for our kids to be doing. We know that that's true. The data is there to show that using a device can have very detrimental negative effects on their lives. Driving a car is a very dangerous thing for our kids to do, right? Some more dangerous than others, based upon my kids and some others that I know. Now, I know a lot of parents who say, my kids don't use devices. And that's fine. That's totally fine. That's their decision. But the analogy that I make is, would you ever, when your kid turns 18, be like, well, prior to 18, my kids never drive because it's just too dangerous. They never drive. And when they turn 18, you're like, okay, here are the keys. Go to town, anything from the grocery store. No training, no guidance, no practice, nothing. It's just go get me something. None of us would do that. That would be insane, right? Like, we know the result of that. It would be devastation and death and destruction. It just would. Like, if they had, they had no idea how to drive a car and we throw them out on the freeway, it'd be awful. And yet, in some ways, we're doing the exact same thing with our devices because we say, well, in my house, we don't do this, 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 and this. And then when they turn 18, they leave our house and immediately they have a device in their hand and they have no idea how to use it. They have no idea how to be productive. They have no idea how to avoid consuming their life away. And it's, and you guys, these things are so addictive that it just, it truly becomes like driving a car without any instruction. It's the same level of danger. And in fact, it may be a even worse because it's a different kind of danger. It's a danger to their long-term mental health, a danger to their spiritual health, a danger to their emotional health. It's probably more dangerous than handing your kids car keys without any training. And so, in my opinion, we have an enormous responsibility to not only allow our kids to use devices, but to train them and teach them how to use devices in the right way. That's the challenge. And here's the great, here's the huge challenge. Most of us don't know how to use devices in the right way, right? Like, I struggle with this. I don't always know how to use devices the right way, and I'm expected to train these children to do that. And it really is a big challenge, but we have to take the time to do so because they really are going to grab those keys at a certain point, and they will drive it off a cliff if we don't we don't teach them the right way to use them. I think I saw a hand over here.
In our house, we've also found it useful in recognizing addiction and also in breaking that addiction and learn how to recognize it in its early stages before it gets too bad. And also they being young and breaking an addiction or being able to take it away because they're exhibiting signs of addiction, they're, you know, withdrawn, they get cranky, you try to like redirect their attention and they, you know, this peaceful, adorable, lovely little creature suddenly becomes a tiger and wants to bite your head off. And in our house, that's an indication, okay, no more of this for a while.
Yeah.
Until they show that they can handle it responsibly. In for us, it's been a way that we can like teach them and teach ourselves in recognizing, both recognizing that and in, I guess, learning how to be productive and not let it consume us instead.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that. So let's go back just a little bit here, you guys. Back to just this general idea of production and consumption. So years ago, they were trying to figure out, so specifically related to addiction, the original studies that they did on addiction were a rat study that was done in like the late 40s, early 50s. This rat study was set up so that they put rats into different cages by themselves, and into that cage they gave them food and, you know, kind of a place to live. And then they also provided two bottles of water. And those bottles of water, one was pure, just regular distilled water. The other one was water laced with opium. And so what they watched was they put the rats into these cages. And over a period of time, they watched what the rats did, which water they decided they preferred. And on a regular basis, they would sacrifice the animals. They'd do brain scans. They would look at the chemicals in the body and to kind of evaluate what was happening as they were drinking this opium-laced or pure water. Over a period of time, they found that 100% of the rats, you know, unsurprisingly, preferred the opium-laced water. And they found that as they transitioned from regular water to this drugged water, the brain chemistry in these rats completely changed. It was a very clear and concise thing that happened. And so that became the model for how we think of addiction, right? Like the drug program, the just Say No, the DARE program, all of that was based on this assumption that addiction is a very chemical thing that happens in our brains. If you partake of some substance, whether it's it's opium or some drug, whether it's alcohol, whether it is even just like pornography or other addictive substances, that there is a brain chemical transition that causes us to become addicted to that substance. And that is the basis of a lot of the treatment programs that we established at that time. Well, that whole idea remained in effect, even, you know, in some places, even till today. But there was an interesting study that was done to kind of challenge that. And the first part of that study was actually the Vietnam War. So you may not realize this, but during the Vietnam War, our soldiers had access to immense amounts of illicit drugs, mostly opium and like pure opium. And at a certain time within the Vietnam War, they found that up to 30% of the soldiers that were serving had become addicted to opium. They were using it on a very, very regular basis. And so they had this idea that addiction is chemical, these guys are addicted, and they started to become very, very concerned with what was going to happen when they returned to the United States. So much so that they spent millions and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars setting up centers for these soldiers to come home and be detoxed and be broken of these addictions so that they could go back into society and be normal fathers and young people again. So the war ended. They expected millions of soldiers to come, or hundreds of thousands, maybe a million soldiers to come into these addiction centers. Well, an interesting thing happened. These soldiers returned from Vietnam, and only about 2% of them ended up in these centers. And the rest just went. Now, some of them, of course, continued those addictions, but a vast, vast majority of them just stopped. And so the researchers who had done the original work on the rats and other researchers were kind of looking at this like, what just happened? If addiction truly is a chemical thing and they didn't go through a chemical detox and we didn't help them, like, what just happened? How is that even possible if addiction is just a chemical thing in our brains? And so another researcher came along and they ran the rat study again. And what they did was the exact same scenario, the exact same kind of rats, the exact number of rats, opium-laced water, pure water. The only difference in the second setup to the first setup is the rats in the second setup were introduced, instead of into their own individual cages, they were put into Rat Park. Rat Park was the place that rats went to live and enjoy their lives. They could play, there was things to play on, there were other rats to interact with, they could be sexually active. All of these things, instead of having them in individualized small cages, they had this utopia, this rat park. They watched the rats, opium water, regular water, they sacrificed them, they looked at their brain chemistry, all of those things were exactly the same. But in Rat Park, not a single rat became addicted to the opium-laced water. Whereas the first time, 100% of them were addicted to the opium-laced water. And for the first time, we started to understand that addiction, yes, while it has a chemical nature, there is chemical changes in our brains and things do happen that cause us to crave and want those other things. Addiction is really more about who we're with and what we're doing as we engage with those substances. The rats in Rat Park drank some of the opium-laced water, but they tended to only do it once or maybe twice. And then, because Rat Park was wonderful, it provided them social interactions, it provided them things to do, ways to produce, way to procreate. They didn't go back to the opium-laced water. They actually preferred the pure water. And so our idea of addiction became very, very different. That it's not necessarily just this idea that if you are introduced. And so sometimes some of this even remains now. We get concerned, I don't want my kid to ever see pornography. If they see pornography, they're going to be addicted. Well, that's not how it works, you guys. How it works is, and I'll tell you exactly how our youth become addicted to pornography, they sit in front of a computer and they play Minecraft. Now, it might be a different game, but it's something that they're sitting there and they're bored and they're lonely and they're anxious, maybe a little bit depressed. And they have these emotions and then something pops up that titillates, that gives them a little bit of a brain chemistry, a bit of a hit, and they immediately, their brains connect, that thing helped me to not feel this anymore. And when that happens, it starts, the brain starts to create a connection between those two things. Addiction doesn't happen because you see pornography one time. It doesn't happen because you drink alcohol one time. It doesn't happen because you smoke one time. It happens because we associate those behaviors and that feeling that we get with these emotional baselines. And we start to think that's the, our brain starts to think that's the solution. And so, in a very real way, you guys, the way we have our kids consuming and producing, it has vast, vast implications on their lives, on their mental health, their emotional health. It's not just the small things. It's the other things in their life as well. And Rebecca, you said this already. This plays out in our real lives. Here's two of my kids. On the left is Keller consuming on a device, and on the right is Melina. And this is, you can't tell. It's hard to tell, but she did an awesome job. She was, I think, 4 or 5 when she did this. So this is her first stuffed penguin that she sewed all by herself. And she had spent days and days and days working on this stuffed penguin. With my kids, and I'm sure your kids are way, way better about this. When my kids are consuming, when they're sitting in front of a screen or they're playing a video game, and we say, okay, it's time to have dinner, time to stop. Oh, my gosh. It's like it's the end of the world. It's like we are like asking them to, I don't know. They freak out. They throw fits. It becomes this real problem. Because like you said, Rebecca, they are very much connected in that consumptive idea. On the other hand, when my kids produce, it's incredible. They're happy. They're pleasure to be around. They have this a different mental state between consumption and production. And so, you guys, what do I mean by production and consumption? Production means anything that we do that we put out into the world is a productive activity. Now, that, there's a very important caveat to that, right? It has to go out into the world. To get the benefit of production, studies have shown that production is better for our kids mentally, emotionally, than consumption. But to get the benefit of it, it can't just be, I made a new song and I hid it away so no one will ever see it. They don't get the same benefit from that. It has to be, I made a new song, and I can't wait to play it for someone. It has to go out into the world. And when that happens, there's a very real thing that happens in their lives. And it's a powerful, powerful thing. And so what I want to talk about with the remaining time that we have, I got to get back through all this stuff. You guys, just a reminder, don't waste your time on devices. I want to talk about just a few things that we can do to try to help our kids go from this consumptive life into a productive life. The first thing, I talked a little bit about this yesterday, but I want to just express it a little further. One of the main reasons our kids don't produce as much as they can is that they are afraid to fail. The idea of creating something and putting it out into the world and somebody not liking it is a real detriment for our kids. And let's be honest, it's a detriment for us as well, right? Like none of us want to put something out and have somebody not like it. And so we have to help our kids fail more often. They need to be really, really comfortable with failure. They need to have opportunities to put themselves out there in a way where the of not succeeding is very, very real. Now, often the question I get is, how do I do that? Right? Because I'm sure some of you guys have kids, you're like, I don't know how to, like, they don't want to fail. They're very afraid of failing. They resist that. And what my answer to that is, it has to start with you. So a tradition that we've picked up in our family that has been really helpful in this, of helping our kids be willing to fail more, is we have created a culture where failure is not only expected, but can be cheered. And so what we do is, at family dinner on Sundays, we sit down and we talk about, hey, what happened this week? What did you learn at church? All of those types of normal things. What were just some of your successes? And we talk about that, and we laugh about things. But then a very specific thing we try to do, and we don't do it every week, but we try to, is we say, okay, what were your failures this week? And failure, by the way, in our family, if failure to try doesn't count. If they're like, yeah, I was supposed to do some math and I didn't, yeah, that doesn't count. So what failure means is you put your heart and soul into something, you tried your best, and it just didn't go the way you wanted it to. And so we say a failure that week, and then we clap and we cheer as a family. Nice job. That's an awesome failure. That's incredible. We don't clap and cheer for the successes that they had. We say, that hey, that's awesome. But we make a big deal about the fact that they put themselves out there and it didn't quite go the way that they wanted. And so within our family, we're trying to create this culture where failure is just, it's just part of it. It's just something that happens on a regular basis, and it's totally okay. There's no problem with failure. Now, I hate failure to try. When my kids say I didn't, you know, that's not okay. But when they really do put their heart and soul into it, and they really try, and it just doesn't go the way they want, that's totally okay. But what I found with this is really interesting. The first times that we tried to do this, hey, what are your failures? Guess what happened? Nothing. They just sat there. They just sat there. They didn't want to talk about anything. And so for about 3 months, what happened was Dad would be like, okay, guys, here's the dumb thing Dad did this week. And some of you guys heard me tell a story about a boy named Nephi yesterday. Those stories were basically invented at this period of time because I had to tell him about all the stupid things that I did and all the failures that I've had in my life. And I would soften it by saying it was a story about a boy named Nephi that totally wasn't me. But what I did was I had to share my failures. I just started putting them out there. Hey, at work this week, I was doing this. And it just blew up. It didn't work. And over a period of time, our kids started to realize, hey, Dad has failures. It's not working out all the time for him. And he seems like a successful person. He's doing okay. He's not like, and it became this, it's okay. It must be okay to have failures. It might not work for all of your families, but this has worked wonders in our family.
Do you have time to give one quick example of what you made up with that?
Let me give you an example really quickly.
She was here yesterday morning.
Yeah. Let me give you an example, actually, of my daughter really quick, one of her failures. And I'll try to do this. I may hold you guys just like a couple minutes more. Is that okay? One of my daughters, Melina, a few years ago, we went to the swimming pool out in Lava. And it's actually Lava, but you guys call it Lava. Out in Lava. And so we went out to Lava, and there's that climbing wall over the swimming pool. And she was pretty young. She was probably 7 at the time. And she was like, Dad, I'm going to climb that wall. And so the entire time, the 2 hours that we were there, she was climbing up this wall, trying to get to the top. And over and over and over, she'd get close and fall, and get close and fall, and get close and fall. And it was just like, she just couldn't quite make it. So we were getting ready to leave. I'm like, Melina, we have to go. And she's like, Dad, one more time. I'm like, go ahead. She climbs up, gets close, and falls and splashes in the water. And she's kind of like deflated by it. It's like, okay, Melina, it's fine. You did a good job. We go home, and that Sunday, we're sitting there, and she's like, Dad, my failure this week is I didn't touch the top of the climbing wall. And I'm like, that's a great failure, Melina. You tried so hard. And we talked about what she could have done differently and what she... And she's like, this week I want to do push-ups because I want to get my arms stronger. And she had all these plans of how to be better. And we clapped. We cheered. We're like, that was incredible. As a family, we applauded her for that. Well, about 2 weeks later, we were back at the pool. And guess where Melina was? She was not deflated by failure. She's like, and she was back on the wall. And it took her another hour and a half of climbing up and falling, climbing and falling. Finally, she got to the top. And I cannot tell you how elated she was. Because she had failed, and it was okay to fail, and she knew she could keep trying, she knew she could do better, and so she went back and she did it again, and she succeeded. And she got out of the water, and we're like, Melina, good job. And she looks at me and goes like, Dad, somebody said the other side's harder. And she went right back in the pool, and she started climbing again. That is the culture of failure that we're trying to develop, this idea that it's okay, you just keep going, you pick yourself up, you keep trying. It doesn't matter that you failed, it's all right. You guys, and if we can't get them to do that, then if we expect them to go produce something that is beautiful to them, that they put their heart and soul into, but then you want them to go, they are not going to be willing to put that out in front of people. It's just too scary. Great book, Mindset by Carol Dweck. She talks about the fact that the way we talk about what our kids are doing makes a huge, huge impact. There's a great story in here about a math test that's given to these students. And they break them up by groups. And the way they talk about their success in the math test, whether they say, hey, you did a great job, or you did a great job because you're really smart. And the other group, they said, you did a great job because you worked really hard. That's the only difference. These students were all about the same level of math. The kids that were told they did a good job because they were smart were less likely to want to take a second challenging test. And they took a third test that was in comparable difficulty to the first test. And their percentage, it was the exact same test with different problems as the first one, their success rate on the test went down 30 percentage points just because they've been told you did a good job because you're smart. The kids that were told, hey, you did a good job because you worked hard, were much, much more likely to want to take a second test that was harder. And on the third test, 30 points. There was a 60-point differential between those two groups of kids simply because of the way they were told about what they were doing. When we talk about production, you guys, it's not about the result. It's not about the outcome. It's not about any of those things. It's the effort. It's the effort that they're putting into it. If we will praise the effort, that's amazing, Melina. That's so awesome that you spent so much time on the climbing wall. And not only even need to talk about getting to the top of the climbing wall. She will have a more likely desire to continue to do that and consider to challenge yourself. One more thing is, one thing that's really helped us in helping our kids produce more is if you will flip their consumption to production. So some of my kids love, the movie example. My kids love to watch videos. They love to watch Studio C. Anybody else have a Studio C addiction in their family? They love to watch Studio C. So the idea of creating a Studio C-like movie is very, very appealing to my kids. And I would much rather have them producing Studio C content than consuming that Studio C content. And so we steer into it. We're like, yeah, go watch a Studio C and then go make something that's similar to that. And they get so excited. They're much, much more likely to go and produce when we flip their consumption into production. So if your kid loves to play video games, don't berate them and get after them about that. Just flip it to production. Hey, you love video games? Why don't we do a course on creating video games? Why don't we do a course on graphic design? Why don't we do something and you flip that consumption into production. You guys, there are so many different ways that we can help our kids produce more. But the reality is we have to do that. The world wants them to consume. They live in a world where their brains are for sale all the time to the highest bidder. In a very real sense, that's not hyperbole. What I mean by that is every single company out there with social media and all of these other types of consumptive activities, their product is not. We get Facebook for free, not because Mark Zuckerberg is a great guy. We get it for free because he takes our attention, our brains, and he sells it to the marketers and the people that are buying the time. That's the product. They live in a time where their brains are literally being sold if we allow that to happen. And we've got to stop that, and we've got to turn their brains into something that's producing and creating. There are huge, amazing, incredible problems out there that need to be solved. There are a lot of things that these kids are going to grow up and they're going to be a part of a generation that solves big problems, but they're not going to do it if they are just consuming constantly. Thank you guys for being here. I appreciate all the comments and your time. I hope you have a good day.